Hey guys, just a quick note before we begin that the show may contain spoilers and adult language, but that's just because we know how to have a good time. Stick around, you'll be glad you did.
You are here for me to enlighten you.
You ever act like this again, you're barred for life.
It's just vile and base.
It's kind of embarrassing.
If you know your lines, then you can forget them.
Oh, I get it. It's very clever.
Hello, peoples, and welcome to Esoterica Cinema, the program where we take films and discuss the hell out of them. My name is Jason Peters, and with me, as always, is the man who crossed state lines and in turn violated his parole to be here, Mr. Ryan Siebold.
What's up, Jason? How's it going, buddy?
not bad. Don't worry. I actually have this feed encrypted.
Great.
So no government agencies are able to track this to figure out where we are, what's going on. Your secret is safe with me, buddy.
A little bit of insider info. Ankle bracelets, a lot more comfy than you'd think. They're pretty comfy. Kind of stylish. Yep. Mine's made by Balenciaga.
And while under house arrest, Ryan has had plenty of time to watch and review our latest movie, which is one hell of a doozy.
Oof.
Tell us about Brian Usna's Society, My Friend.
That's right, buddy. Today's film had me asking myself, is this the actual goop that Gwyneth Paltrow has been alluding to all these years? That's right, we're talking about the 1989 body horror classic Society from director Brian Usna, who we've previously discussed as a producer of classics like Reanimator and From Beyond. Society tells the tale of Bill Whitney, played perfectly here by Billy Warlock. Such a name, such a great horror name. Who's suffering
such a
from...
wonderful name, dude. Right. I love it. Like, how could you not be an actor with
that's
a name
right.
like that?
You get the part. Yeah, you're hired. Billy's suffering from anxiety and paranoia about his family and circle of friends, is seeking therapy, and by the second act takes a descent into madness as his darkest fear as his darkest fears are proven to be just scratching the surface, leading us to the film's conclusion that is so wildly satisfying and equal parts hilarious and grotesque that it will have you asking yourself, what the shunt to jive just watch. The film co-stars Charles Lucia, Concetta Diagnese, if I'm saying that right, Patrice Jennings, all as his family of sorts, Evan Richards as Bill's best friend Milo, Devin DeVasquez, Tim Bartel, and so many others. The ensemble is actually huge for such a low-budget film. This was shot on a budget of $2 million, by the way, and was released overseas in 1989, but took a few years to get a domestic release here in the States. But it eventually earned cult film status, which brought it to our doorstep. This was my first watch of Society, Jason. We'll get to what I thought about it shortly, but as always, I've got to ask you, what did you think about this movie, bud?
And as always, Ryan, I'm going to be happy to tell you and our audience, but first, do want to ask everyone watching or listening, if you like what we do on this show, please do go ahead, give us the like, subscription, follow, rate us, tell your friends, do all that stuff. It really helps us out and we appreciate it. As well, if there's any movie that you would like to see us do, we'd be happy to do so. If you're on YouTube, you can leave that in the comments right below. If you're listening on the podcast, you can send an email, esotericacinema@gmail.com, or you can go directly to the website, esotericacinema.com, and you'll be able to reach out to us there. So, Ryan, let me go ahead and tell you what I thought about Society, okay? And I have some things to say.
Oh, firstly, I'm sure you do.
Ryan, I absolutely adore this film. You know, is it juvenile? Yes. Is it gross? Unquestionably. Do I wonder if it speaks ill of my character? Little bit, but all I can tell you is that Society is responsible for images that, for better or worse, I've literally never seen in any other film, right? And despite being admittedly clunky and not always logical, Society has a freshness and a virility that is often lacking in low-budget 80s horror, right? And yet at the same time, it contains a sly sense of satire. Although I do have to admit the film is not always as intelligent or profound as it believes it is. Still, the confidence of Usna's direction paired with surprisingly effective and vibrant art direction and cinematography, you take that and you wrap it all up in Screaming Mad George's deliriously glorious practical effects and just that huge, batshit crazy third act. It all adds up to a wonderfully phantasmagoric carnival funhouse of a film. I thoroughly enjoyed every moment of it. How about you, good friend?
Hell yeah, brother. I absolutely love this movie. It was a perfect blend of body horror meets 80s schlocky comedy in the realm of Revenge of the Nerds, Police Academy, or Ski Patrol. Billy Warlock shines here, playing a solid 80s teen in classic fashion as he was 28 years old at the time, giving his role vibes of Michael J. Fox or Emilio Estevez. The ensemble of characters around him was one perfectly portrayed caricature and trope after another, and I mean that as a compliment. The real hero of this film, though, and I know you've got a bit to say about this, you've already teed me up on this, was the practical effects by Screamin' Matt George, who seemed to be completely unleashed to just go creatively wild on this. The film isn't without its faults, of course, just like you said, but the most important thing I walked away from this film with was just an overwhelming sense of fun. By the time the credits rolled, I stood up off my couch and gave this movie a slow clap of absolute respect.
Also, I do think the Michael J. Fox comparison was on point, because as I was watching it, that was so to me, it was a blending. It was MJF, as I like to call him.
OK.
And it was half that and then half John Stamos.
OK, you had John Stamos.
And I think a large part of that was also just because of his hair. He had that like thick, lush mane of John Stamos hair. And so I think that's part of the heavy lifting there, too. You know,
have mercy. So. Yeah, I'll take some Kokomoa this movie. That's for sure. I got the puns.
Now, Ryan, obviously there's a lot we can talk about with this film, and we will, you know, it would be very easy to sort of fall into this trap of just talking about the third act, because so much of this film relies on the strength of that third act.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of other film there that we're going to go ahead and address here. And I think one of the things worth discussing is just the overall tone of the film, because I think that's one of the things that makes this film different and more idiosyncratic than some of its brethren at the time, you know?
Sure.
And so when we talk about that tone, I think that there's this interesting juxtaposition of two different elements at play.
Okay.
And the first is this sense of paranoia, right?
Yes.
So when the film starts out, you know, we see it immediately leaning into that paranoia with that scene where Billy is going through the house and he's got the knife, you know, and it's in the dark and we've got the sort of handheld camera. We're not sure if that's
the
like
opening
a POV
sequence
thing. Yeah, absolutely. You
Dude,
know, and it really
it,
just leans right into
on
that
so
paranoia.
Many Dutch angles and shaky handheld. I loved it. It's like, oh, yeah, baby, give me those 80s Dutch angles.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and I think that those little subtleties kind of help, again, to bring about that sense of paranoia that's going to exist for Billy and
sure.
for us as the audience to a degree through that. And then we also do see that represented through the eyes of the David Blanchard character, right?
Yeah.
Who is Billy's sister's ex-boyfriend. And he's the one who records the evidence of the, you know, he gets the audio of the sort of orgy thing that's going on before we have that fully revealed. But then at the same time, you know, on the other side of it, juxtaposed to that, this film is very playful and this film is very self-aware. And in many ways, it's like, you know, it kind of telegraphs what's going on really early on.
Yeah.
And then it's sort of just like giving you like little winks and nods and nudges like, you know where we're going? Like, yeah, we're going to get there, buddy. We're not there yet, but you know where we're going, right? So I thought at that point it was really fun. And, you know, of course, with the bonkers third act, it's like, I feel like most films would go out of their way to sort of hold that back and keep it a mystery. And that's very fun. But what ended up surprising me about that is the joy that I had in just the anticipation of getting somewhere, knowing where I was going. Does that make sense?
It makes total sense. I have in my notes, if they mention society one more ham-fisted time again, they're going to have to look right into the camera. Like, you know, like you're going to do great in society. And then it looks over right into the camera.
That's like, just like winks. Like,
yeah. Wink. Yeah. You know what I mean, right?
You know.
They don't know, but you know.
We all know what's going on here.
You know, the kids don't know, but we know.
Yeah. No, I mean, this, you talk about tone. I mentioned right up front, this has a lot of 80s schlocky comedy. It really reminded me of Ski Patrol. I don't know if you've ever seen Ski Patrol. It's famously parodied by the Aspen episode of South Park.
Stan Darsh is more like it.
So it also had, I don't know if you caught this, but it reminded me a lot of Peter Jackson's early work, which we've covered on this show.
With
movies like Brain Dead or Dead Alive. Obviously, the practical effects, the way everything kind of led to something else in kind of a Rube Goldberg thing, everything kind of mattered, even though it was low budget and super cheesy. I felt that everything, there wasn't a lot of fat here. I really appreciated even the slower moments were funny and charming. The actors knew what kind of movie this was and leaned into it.
Sure, yeah.
Which was also
definitely
very well done. As I'm thinking that that this reminded me of Peter Jackson's early work. I wonder if that means that there is a world in the cinematic multiverse where Yuzna goes on to direct a Lord of the Rings adaptation. And
dude, I can...
Dude, I want to visit that world. That's a world I want to live in. Brian Yuzna as Lord of the Rings.
So here's the thing, dude. Yeah, that would be something. But I could absolutely, and on top of that, I could absolutely see a world where Peter Jackson doesn't make Lord of the Rings, where like his New Line Gambit doesn't pay off.
Sure.
Imagine what Peter Jackson's career looks like if he doesn't make Lord of the Rings, right? How many more Dead Alives would he have made, right?
Yeah.
And so for a film like that, I could absolutely see him pairing up with Yuzna as his director, especially like, let's say Yuzna had something going on with his boy, Stuart Gordon, and Gordon drops out. Like,
sure.
Dude, old school Peter Jackson is a perfect replacement for him. They've got that zany kind of sensibility, sure. That Looney Tunes, yeah, right there with Joe Dante, right? Like the three of them could exist in this sort of similar universe, you know, you're talking about.
Well, like in Dead Alive, we talked about like the soup eating scene where the people's faces are all kind of falling apart and falling in the soup and the guests are over.
Damn fine custard.
Like that could be right in line with a movie like this or produced by Ryan Yuzna. So
absolutely. Yeah. Now, obviously part of the film's appeal is this very, on top of that, a very unique aesthetic, right? So
sure.
I'm curious how you personally would sort of describe society's aesthetic to maybe someone who hasn't seen it and was considering maybe watching it. And then from there, you know, how much do you like, love, hate that aesthetic, et cetera?
Again, Police Academy meets The Fly. So it's super cheesy comedy, over the top. All the high schoolers are, like I said, pushing 30, you know, realistically, seriously, they're all pushing 30.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
It's so 80s laced in the sense that everyone's absolutely rocking mullets. I kept looking for Oakley razor blades or razors, whatever they were called at the time. It could be
the sunglasses.
Yeah, it's just like all 80s all the way, but not like John Hughes 80s. Again, okay. This is like Police Academy or Ski Patrol. I can't stress this enough. It's like super cheesy. It's a world where, you know, a guy's going to come in and start making beep boop noises like in the Police Academy. It's so silly. The mom, was it Clarissa's mom that would show up randomly and eat hair or kind of talk in sentence fragments like a Mongo type from Blazing Saddles. She doesn't really even do a whole lot. Like I was expecting her to save the day at the end when she was palling around with Milo, that she was going to, you know, wreck some shit when she got into the society.
I mean, she does get kind of a little bit of that moment where she's like, whatever her name is. And he's like, hair. And
sure.
Like, it's with the cop or something. It's like one very brief moment, but it's, man, not like she's like,
up, like
saving the day or anything.
They kept
like that,
bringing her in like, you're going to want to know this. You're going to want to remember her. You know, again, the wink and the nods the camera, and then she never really paid off. So I was kind of waiting for her to have her moment, but she was welcome comedic.
In that respect, can we call her Chekhov's mom?
Chekhov's mom. Well played. I love that. Yeah. If you're going to bring in Clarissa's mom, you got to use her. Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. You know, and it is interesting because I do think that a lot of that is intentional. That's sort of like you're talking about 80s, 90s sitcom feel, because you know, in looking into some of what Yuzna was going for, I had a chance to check out the audio commentary track and some of the special features that are on that like Arrow DVD. Mm-hmm. And so he was actually talking about how he very much wanted to give it a high school comedy vibe. So that's exactly what you're picking up on. And that was actually 100% intentional, you know, and that's part of why we see the art direction and the cinematography the way that it is, because horror films should not generally be this bright and this vivid, and everything is so well lit.
Yeah.
It's almost a little bit like, you know, what Ari Aster would do in a very different way, obviously. But, you know, 30, 40 years later with Midsommar, you know, and just how it's like daytime horror, you know, and that kind of became a thing for a moment. And so he was almost doing like daytime horror, Yuzna, that is, before it was in vogue, shall we say. Mm-hmm. And I think that ends. And part of it, too, is he was aware that the end was going to be so impactful and so many people were going to be grossed out by it, that he did feel that sort of giving it a playful vibe would help sort of soften that up a little bit, right?
I do love the smell of the hunt and the taste
of the shunt.
So also worth noting, really, really interestingly, the original draft of the script, it didn't have any of the body horror elements. So really what was going on with society was just very simply a like blood sucking cult. So they were basically just vampires of sorts, essentially.
Okay.
And they just fed off the blood of the lower class. And Yuzna was like, you know, his sensibilities are a little bit more Lovecraftian. He likes some like weird shit like that. And so he was like, you know, that's a little bit rote. Is there a way that we can sort of elevate this by making it the same? You know, they still feed off of them, but like, you know, let's go more into like the body horror element of it. And so he then worked with the writers to really bring that out and then, you know, tease it in little ways along the way with some of the different, you know, tiny little body horrors and like the twisted bodies that are usually, you know, a torso is often like, you know, facing the wrong way from the legs in various different scenes. And so a lot of that came about, again, just because it's like, I don't want to do, you know, blood sucking vampires. Let's find a way to make that, you know, kind of different. And I think that's why also going back to the, you know, wanting to do a high school comedy, that's where we get that acting sensibility, right? Like, nobody's going to say this is like a, you know, greatly acted film. I do think that Billy Warlock is good. He's charismatic, right? He's got a fresh face. He's young and attractive. And,
sure,
you know, but like the girlfriend cheerleader character is, you know, just a caricature of the, like, there's a lot of cartoon caricatures of people in this movie.
Right.
Pretty much everyone outside of Billy, really.
But they're good in this. Like, they knew what movie this was, and they're perfect for this role. Like, I don't know that I would go seek out their other work, per se. But the bad guy, Tad Ferguson, which, by the way,
Ted.
best douche name of all time, Ted Ferguson. Yeah, he played his role so spot on. The little nerd kid played his role so spot on. Milo, perfect
Milo.
Sidekick.
Great casting.
So much so that when I watched this film, you kind of set me up, like, just got through it. It's a little cheesy, but the third act is where it pays off. And just, you know, it's an hour and a half, get through it. Because you had seen this before.
Yeah.
I had not.
Yes, I have. Yeah.
I found myself enjoying the first two acts way more than I expected to.
Nice.
Not more than third act, but definitely way more than I expected to. So.
Absolutely. Yeah. And one of the things I think that also adds to that is that, you know, Yuzna never shies away from showing you the stuff, right? Like, that's one of the, like, most maddening things about reading Lovecraft is that he's got these really interesting ideas. But then when it comes to, like, actually showing you the horrors from beyond, it's always like, oh, it was so grotesque that to describe it would break a man's mind. And it's like, that's a really cheap way to get out of, like, giving me what I'm literally here for, which are these, like, crazy horrors from beyond, right?
Yeah.
And so Yuzna never takes that way out. You know, he's like, I'm not going to, you know, hide my, you know, creature or do the shunting in the shadows and, you know, half light everything and have it be super dark and then ask your imagination to do a lot of the heavy lifting. He's like, no, like, you're here for me to show you this big batshit crazy insanity, you know?
Sure.
And he wants to show it to you. He wants to show it to you up front and personal. He wants to do that work for you so you can just sit back and enjoy the craziness. And I think I really appreciate that about this film as well.
So for any of our viewers that are picking up, we keep using the word shunt. I will just cue you in very quickly and let you know that that's pretty much the third act finale, wherein these body feasting or body absorbing, consuming monsters that have always existed here have this physical body horror orgy of sorts where they're consuming all the people that aren't a part of their cabal, if you will, or cult. So, and it gets very graphic, and all the effects are done by Screaming Mad George. Speaking of which, Jason, can we talk a little bit about Screaming Mad George and a little bit of his accolades and what makes him so special?
Absolutely, we can, sir. Yeah. So, an interesting thing is the entire, firstly, just to explain the entire way that Yuzna got hooked up with Screaming Mad George, because Screaming Mad George was still a Japanese artist at that time. He hadn't really come over to the States as much. He had a little bit. He was just starting to come over because he had gotten some work with Stan Winston on Predator.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and then from there, he was getting set up to go work with Wes Craven on the Nightmare on Elm Street movies, which he would do Nightmare on Elm Street 3 And then for 4, he did the really famous scene with the cockroach where the guy gets turned into the cockroach and then goes to the Roach Motel and gets killed. Like that entire scene was screaming Mad George. So
that's what's up.
Yeah. He had a really sort of interesting arc, and Yuzna had some Japanese investors that were like, hey, we've got this super cool dude, Screaming Mad George, starting to come out. You know, it was really big over there. And so they ended up hooking the two of them up. And for anyone who's not familiar with him, he's got a very unique style where it's a lot of sort of these machinations of like what I would call bodily transmutation or something, right? Mm-hmm. Where it's this bizarre, unsettling imagery. It tends to be provocative and it straddles the line between like psychedelic and horrific. A lot of like, you know, mouths coming out of mouths coming out of mouths and like, you know, eyes in, you know, double hands. It reminded me a lot of sort of the stuff that we see from like Cronenberg, some of the imagery that we might have seen in like some of the Guillermo del Toro works and whatnot. So, and not only that, dude, but he's actually like written and performed heavy metal music and directed Japanese cyberpunk videos. And one of the craziest things of all is he developed this like insane PlayStation 1 game called Paranoia Escape.
Oh, that
is like a 3D action pinball game. Through these like twisted Hieronymus Bosch like berserk hellscapes.
Okay,
it's madness. You can go on YouTube and find a 30-minute playthrough and watch like 3 minutes. You get the sensibility.
Yeah, I mean, in the world of like physical effects in the horror world, you got like Rick Baker, Stan Winston, Phil Tippett to a lesser degree. I mean, he's amazing.
Sure, yeah.
He just didn't do quite as much horror as some of these other guys. Screaming Mad George falls right into that ilk. Tom Savini is right in there as well. Worked with George Romero for many years, but yeah, and then went on to Robert Rodriguez and stuff like that. But Screaming Mad George, you know, it almost kind of had a little bit of like a Tool music video vibe to it. A little bit of GWAR stuff going on. Just
absolutely.
Yeah.
He actually opened for GWAR with his band.
Once upon a time. I didn't know that.
He did a lot of like theatrical stage shit like that. Like he would bring his little like Roach TV set out and utilize that. And like, yeah, he was very, very theatrical.
Yeah.
And I think part of why he's not more of a household name is he just never got those crossovers, right? Like Stan Winston's doing Jurassic Park and Rick Baker's doing Nutty Professor.
Right.
And just, you know, Screaming Mad George's aesthetic was not like he was only interested in doing these like really sort of hellacious and gothic works. So he never really had that like crossover opportunity. But one of the interesting things to note as well is apparently he was super intense on set and everyone said he really justified the moniker, the Screaming Mad George moniker.
Okay.
And part of that is he was talking about it, and apparently he was only sleeping like 3 hours a day for the entirety of the shoot, more or less.
Oh, shit.
Because, as always with indie films, right, we don't have the money, we don't have the time. And so,
yeah.
Generally speaking, each one of those shunting sculptures, because they are latex sculptures, they're made entirely from latex. He's doing all of the scraping and designing and all of that. And he said, usually for a work like this, he would get 5 to 6 days. And Yuzna only gave him 24 hours for each sculpture.
Wow.
So he's literally having to work 5 times as hard. And I'm sure making you know, different sacrifices along the way. And so, but because of that, apparently it was a little difficult to work with between the two of them, because Yuzna wasn't always as aware of what he was asking. And so, you know, George would be scrambling to get this like giant sculpture done. And then Brian would be like, hey, you know, can I just get you to break off real quick and go make some fake tits on the girl in the shower? And he'd be like, what the hell are you talking about? No,
no, no, no, no, no.
No, I literally cannot. Right. And then and everyone like, geez, what's his problem? Right.
Yeah,
so
right.
I think, you know, like, I think that he was under a ton of pressure while
a lot
he was
of it was situational.
It.
Yeah. And it was Yuzna's first real feature directorial debut. So
correct. Absolutely.
He was, you know, learning a lot as he went. That, you know, he had produced a lot for our old pal Stewie G, but Stuart Gordon. But yeah, this was pretty much his directorial debut, aside from a couple short films. So, yeah, you know, he was learning, and I'm sure Screaming Mad George was taking the brunt of those lessons. Or the shunt of the lessons, I should say.
Absolutely. And what's interesting, too, because, you know, so often these things go this way, is he actually had a really solid team of VFX artists, Screaming Mad George, that is. And one of them was a dude named Nick Benson, who wasn't, you know, a super big guy at the time, but would go on to be a legendary makeup artist in his own right, who worked on films such as The Blob and Night of the Demons.
Oh,
and
wow.
Actually ran the special effects department for the movie Tremors.
Hell so, yeah.
Yeah, really solid guy as well. And he was sort of like one of the guys who was acting as the puppeteer during the whole shunting thing at the end.
Okay.
Because, you know, we don't realize that it's this giant mass of latex. It's basically like a giant latex blanket of sorts, right?
Yeah.
With all these crazy sculptures. And then underneath there's people, you know, and they're moving stuff around and they're making it sort of undulate. And they were like, it was really not that pleasant because all these actors are having an orgy basically on top of you.
Yeah.
You don't realize it, but there's scenes where it's like, you know, when it first happens, where they're like pouring champagne, you know, down the guy's gullet, and like it's just like literally spilling down on top of like Nick Benson and these other dudes who are trying to puppeteer this giant thing and getting splashed with champagne
while people
are like having an orgy on top of them, and it's like 90 something degrees, and it's got to be like, why are we doing this, bro?
And it's hour three.
Is this what you
out
thought
of
14? This was gonna be?
Yeah, you're on hour 3 of 14. Now you're all sticky and shit. You got 11 more hours to go.
Yeah.
That
it's getting
sucks.
Hot. It's like baking that sugary shit right on top of you.
Yeah.
George is pissed off. Like, and then also of note too is, I forget the exact material. I wish I had written it down, but the substance that they used for like the slime,
the
basically.
Goop?
Yeah. The goop, so to speak. It's the same material that they used to thicken jelly donuts.
Oh God.
Yeah. So they basically had like jelly donut, like substance that they were just like having to writhe around in
this
on top
gelatinous.
Of everything else.
Yeah. Just,
correct.
Yeah. Like I said, so, you know, those were probably 10 to 12 hour days, bare mins, because he's, like you said, he's sleeping 3-4 hours a night. So, you know, he's coming off of all the setup overnight, probably waking up at like 3 a.m, get on set at 4, working all day. And then, you know, finishing it off just sticky and schlocky and goopy, and all for a movie that didn't even originally get released in the States. It ended up earning cult status, but it's not like, you know, he cranked it out and everyone, you know, he's getting a standing ovation at, you know, Cannes Film Festival or something. Like you said, like, you know, you're comparing this to Ari Aster and stuff like that. Like, that's really cool and all, but this movie didn't get that kind of attention and or money or anything. So
now that does bring me to a question that I'd like to ask just you personally, which is that, you know, the movie didn't do that well and it did take a long time to find its footing. So given everything about it, where would you put society in the annals of, you know, film history or cult horror or, you know, all of that? Like, where does society shelve in when we look at, you know, horror's past and history?
So the one thing that I really was taken aback by this, I was expected to have a little more horror element. Now, it's body horror, definitely.
Sure.
But it didn't have any like startling or scary moments at all. So as long as you could handle gross stuff and definitely some controversial material, just, you know, with there's some incest or you know, implied incest and stuff that was going on. We find out later that wasn't the case. But other than that, it's a mild, very mild nudity. Blink and you miss it. Nudity. This can really be enjoyed by almost anybody. This wasn't overly gross. This wasn't overly scary. It was definitely overly gross, but it was not
it was
overly scary.
Gross.
So I would say, you know, this kind of, again, I keep bringing this up, but I would say I would put this right around Dead Alive. I would say I liked that movie a little bit more.
Yes, of course.
But I would put this over, and this is controversial, but I'm going to say I liked this more than Reanimator.
Wow. Nice, dude. Awesome.
But it's not scary like Nightmare on Elm Street. Even though Nightmare on Elm Street, you go back and watch those and like Freddy is way funnier than you remember him. And those movies are way schlockier.
In the later ones. In the first one, he's still, but like, but yeah, by the time you get to 3 or 4, he's just like, I got you, bitch. Meh.
Yeah, right.
It's like literally doing vaudeville, like, ha, cha, 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 cha.
He literally does do vaudeville. Yeah, yeah. Right.
Da, 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 da,
hello,
da.
My baby. Yeah, it's very Mel Brooksian. But yeah. This wasn't scary at all, and it definitely wasn't body horror in the way of like The Fly or Cronenberg, like The Brood or anything like that. This was way schlockier than that. So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I agree. I don't even think you can call this really like a true horror film. I think if anything, it's, you know, horror satire. And that's honestly like not something that we see too much. It's also, it kind of goes hand in hand with like horror comedy, right? Like, they're so hard to pull off.
Sure.
And most of them don't really work. And, you know, when they do, they're really good. But I was trying to think of what a comp for this film would be. And the only thing I came across that was similar, that's still very different, would be like Larry Cohen's The Stuff, right?
Okay.
Which is sort of like a body horror, but it's also got this cheesiness to it. And it's a satire, in that case, on commercialism, whereas this one is like a satire on class structure. And so, similarly, that film's like not super smart with its satire, but just the fact that they're willing to go to these places in terms of a horror film automatically kind of sets them apart from some of their contemporaries. And then the other one, you know, that's a more recent example that I think is similar but different, but, you know, we both love this film, that's Cabin in the Woods, right?
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about that film is that's a horror satire, but it's a horror satire of horror specifically.
Yes.
So it's not like it ends up becoming this sort of meta experience, right? Whereas these two other films in Society and The Stuff are satirizing commercialism and class structure specifically. So it gives it like a different flavor.
Sure.
But there are certainly, and, you know, also on top of that, there are certainly some horror tropes that are in there, but it's really more in kind of like the script than, you know, the actual film. Like, for example, there's not a single drop of blood that appears in this entire film. I think maybe someone gets like punched in the face, so maybe their nose bleeds for a minute or something like that, right? But there's not any actual stabbings or any of that. And from what I understand, too, that was very intentional, because Yuzna knew that he was going to be screwed when it came to the censors for that third act shunting scene. And so it's like, hey, you know, if we can go in a similar way to the way that Evil Dead 2 didn't use red blood because they knew they were going to get hammered. This movie used slime instead of blood in hopes that they could like lobby their case. I don't think it worked. I think the domestic release still ended up being unrated, to be completely honest. So there is an incest subplot here. The film doesn't go too much into it. But interestingly, Yuzna is of the opinion that, you know, horror, you sort of use it to explore some of those taboo elements, right? And so he wanted to make the film more taboo than it already was with that third act climax. Mm-hmm. And so he input the whole subplot of incest just, again, to make it more provocative, to make it a little bit more taboo.
Okay.
But it's not like it's done in a super graphic way. You do kind of tell at first, it's like, that dad's being a little porny with his daughter, but like, it's not that long before you realize, like, oh, okay, this is obviously something more than like, well, what's going on. And it's not that, you know,
Billy, even says as much in the therapy set, one of his therapy sessions. He's like, you know, oh, nothing major, just a little mild family incest. And then takes a bite out of the apple. It's like, oh shit, no big deal.
It's a little incest between you and a friend, right?
Yeah. But the way I kind of took it in the resolve of it all was that we don't even know. It's never explained really what these creatures are. They do seem to be part of some sort of conglomerate of like an alien creature or another species that we haven't identified, but they're monster beings of sorts. And they all, in the shunting in the third act, they all kind of pile on. And when they get wet, they turn slippery, goopy, and they all kind of merge together. And that's how they absorb other bodies into society, which is their conglomerate of sorts. And so, you know, once we find that out, then all the incest stuff that they're alluding to is really just because everyone is of this ilk other than Billy, really, and everyone in his family, certainly. So if it seems a little touchy grabby, it's just because they're getting wet and goopy and they're like merging together and shunting. So, you know, it's just, you know, they're not human for starters. We identify that very quickly. But then more so, it's not of a sexual nature. It's of a shunting nature. So however you want to classify that,
which
is
inherently sexual
scale.
But it's a whole separate thing. It's kind of its own thing here.
Yeah.
And let's go ahead and acknowledge too that, you know, for all of the damage it may have done, you know, eventually, this is one of the awesome things that came out of the home video revolution and the DVD and Blu-ray revolution and all of that. Like, did it take some of the experience away from theaters? Yes. And we're kind of seeing that, you know, now. But at the same time, it gave legs to films like this, you know?
Sure.
This is one of those films where if we didn't have the chance to go watch this at home and rediscover it decades later, we wouldn't be here talking about this. We never would have watched it. We would never have these images burned into the backs of our retinas for the rest of our lives, right? Like, once you see that shunting scene, you're never going to forget it, for better or for worse. Hopefully you enjoy that sort of thing. If not, apologies. But hey, so, but yeah, I mean, a film like this just is never going to stand a chance at the box office, you know? So it's really cool that we have this opportunity to go ahead and explore these films back home. All right, well, Ryan, before we wrap things up here, we're going to go ahead and do a new feature that we're introducing here on Esoterica Cinema called Top 3 Favorite Moments. Ryan, go ahead and tell us your top 3 favorite moments from Brian Usna's Society. I can't wait to see what they are.
Dude, this was so hard to narrow down. You kind of threw this at me. You're like, pick 3 favorite moments. And I was like, phew, dude, this whole movie's back-to-back favorite moments. I love this movie. The first one, there's no way that we don't have the same one, at least on one of these. And the first one is the one I think we're going to have to emulate here, or the Venn diagram overlaps a bit. And that is Inside Out Tad. It was absolutely flawless. When Billy goes to finish him off at the very end, he throws his hand up his butt like he's going to bowling ball status and grabs him by the eyes and turns him inside out, which leaves the whole room aghast, and he's able to find his way out of the room and save himself. The next one is anything with the judge. That guy would come in chomping a cigar, such an 80s villain. Reminded me of the box art from an old 80s, maybe early 90s hair metal album, Dirty Rotten, Filthy, Stinkin' Rich, I believe is by Warrant. And then we have the beach scene, which...
Okay.
So this is a little outside, but I know obviously this is a body horror film and it would be an easy choice to say, oh, it's this body horror moment or that body horror moment. But what made this film stand out to me so much was all the charm in the middle. And like we talked about earlier, it's those ski patrol moments. It's, you know, the little kids squirting sunscreen on Billy's face. I'm going to get you. And then he runs off. It's very much a Better Off Dead, I want my $2 kind of humor or vibe in those moments. And so the beach scene really stood out to me, where it was comforting to know that even when not a lot was happening, I was still in good hands.
Absolutely. Yeah. So for me, my top 3 favorite moments. So yeah, again, all 3 of them could have easily come from the shunting. So for my number 3, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to do the one of the almost opening scenes where he's speaking to the psychiatrist and he goes to take the bite out of the apple and it's got all the worms and stuff inside, right?
Right.
I just think that's a really cool way to sort of introduce, like, oh yeah, this is going to be a super weird world that we're in, you know, where an apple can have worms inside, because it's going to take us so long to get to that shunting moment that we really need to have some of those teases along the way. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a really effective way to sort of introduce that and also allude to the fact that, you know, when he does pull Ted inside out, that, you know, we've got all those worms and insects and creatures and stuff that are inside. Also, dude, super funny note here real quick, because you wouldn't expect it. So of all people, Nick Benson and some of the other guys, some of the other not lead guys, were the ones that actually ended up bringing the Inside Out Ted Ferguson to life. And they decided to go ahead and use bugs and worms and maggots and all that sort of stuff. Apparently, it turns out that Screaming Mad George has a phobia of insects and stuff. So he was like staying 10 feet away from the body at all times. He's like, nah, that's fucking gross. I'm not touching that.
Wonder how he handled that cockroach scene in Nightmare on Elm Street then.
I know, right? That's what I thought was so weird. Of all people, you'd think that, you know, that would be the last one.
Yeah.
My second moment is just the butthead moment at the end. And I have to admit that part of it is because that scene, that image of him with that butthead, was the first image that I saw that even brought this film to my attention. Like, I had no idea this film existed, and I was on Twitter at the time, and I was going, you know, scrolling and through one of my, you know, movie accounts that I follow,
and it was like a that meme image, or something.
Yeah, exactly. And that image was there with like the butthead guy, and I was like, what is that?
I love it.
How am I this old and I don't know what image this is from? That is absolutely a movie where I should have seen it and known what it's from. And so I went out, checked it out, learned about this movie, Society, and, you know, the rest is history.
It's like seeing the shrunken head guy from Beetlejuice for the first time. You're like, what the fuck is that?
I have to know more about this, right?
Yeah.
And so, and then my number one moment is the fist through the bottom, going all the way through the judge, the cigar chomping judge.
Oh, yeah.
Fists the guy, it goes all the way through his stomach, comes out his mouth, and then he like rips his own face off and stuff. And that's just, I literally laughed out loud so hard when that moment came, because it was just so ridiculous and over the top. In a ridiculous and over the top movie, this was a moment that just absolutely stood out.
Right. That is such a testament to the vibe of this movie, because the way you're describing that sounds so horrific, and it sounds like you should be cringing in horror, and yet you're laughing hysterically because of the way it's portrayed, how it's handled. Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's just kudos to the way, you know, the whole tone and vibe to this movie, because this movie probably should not have worked as a script, but the way Yuzna did it, the way Screaming Mad George did it, all these people that were involved, the actors and so forth, it's just chef's kiss of a movie, dude. I really had a lot of fun watching it.
Definitely. I also do want to give an honorable mention to the Devil Horn fist head guy.
Oh, yeah.
that was awesome. And that was actually something where Screaming Mad George did a lot of artwork as well. He actually went to an art school, like a fine art school, and did paintings.
Okay.
And one of the images, so he did his thesis project was to do a self-portrait. And so it was, you know, this Dali-esque madness, as you can imagine someone like him would do. And one of the images that he had was of that guy. It was a guy with a devil horn fist, but the fist had replaced his head. And so Yuzna was like, I feel like we need like one more creature here. And George was like, hey, I have this idea. Can we do this? And he was like, son of a bitch, you sure we can. Go and do that right now. You know, so so that particular image is kind of a little bit of not a passion project, but it's a direct reflection of George's artwork specifically, as opposed to bringing someone else's vision to life, you know?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So three awesome moments on both sides of the aisle. Ryan, we will continue to our three adjectives feature. Why don't you go ahead and just break it down real quick for any new audience members and give us your three adjectives.
Absolutely, buddy. Three adjectives are, if you had just finished this movie and one of your best friends called you up, like Jason calls me up, and says, what did you think about this movie? How would you describe this in just a few words or a quick little paragraph or sentence or whatever? And so mine, as quick example, are 80s hair metal, because this was exactly 80s hair metal. It's not like full-on metal. It's like schlocky cheesy metal, and it's got the mullets to prove it. My next one is schlock and awe, because it's not quite shock and awe, because it's filled with schlock, baby, and I love it. And in the world of cult cinema, I'm calling this one Cinematology, as a good pairing of cinema and Scientology, because this is a cult film. Baby, sign me up. Check my thetans. I'm raring and ready to go. This is an instant classic, and I loved it. Jason, how about you?
Awesome, dude. So my first, I was really trying to go for like a triple alliteration, and I didn't quite hit it. my first adjective is viscous. This is an incredibly viscous film. You could just feel the slime all over you, and that, especially in that third act. And even with some of the little moments along the way, you know, the thing beaten out of the sister's back and a lot of the twisted bodies and stuff like that. We've got vibrant, because again, this is just a very vibrant film. It's got vibrant acting. It's got vibrant cinematography. It's got vibrant art direction. It's got vibrant, special effects and all of this. So it really is not a traditional horror in that respect. And then the other is provocative. You know, this is a film that's like trying to get a response out of, you know, it doesn't just want to like disappear into the background forever. It really wants you to remember it, you know, and it's going to do that with some of the incest along the way. That's a little uncomfortable. Some of the twisted body horror stuff. And then of course this giant third act, but then also just, you know, the hammering of, you know, the rich against the poor, and, you know, if you're on the lower elements of, you know, social class, you ain't shit to this world, and blah, blah, blah. And so, you know, it's trying to get a rise out of you in certain ways, but it's also just sort of one of those movies that's such a big cuddly teddy bear of a movie, right? Reflective of Brian Yuzna's personality, that, you know, it's, it doesn't end up hitting as hard as it could otherwise. So
it's guar. Like, I really like that description. It really is guar, because guar is like silly, obviously very gory. I took some friends to go see guar several years ago. They had no idea who guar was. They were scared shitless, but they had a great time. Blood going all over the audience. But we're all, you know, laughing. And it's just, it's total, absolute horrified silliness. And this movie fits right in there.
Absolutely. Yeah. So let's go ahead and finish up with just some final thoughts. And I think that for a film like this, you know, I ask myself, who is society for, right? And I will say that Society is not a film for everyone, but it is a film for everyone who likes ridiculous, gross-out humor, insane Lovecraftian creatures made with real practical effects, and psychedelic bizarre horror imagery. If anyone out there is at all familiar with the Kentaro Miura manga Berserk, you'll find a lot of the world's visuals here have been inspired by that, as imagined by Screaming Mad George and Brian Usna. And while it is true that the acting and certain logical gaps leave us wanting in certain respects, the confident direction, the inspired execution, and the maniacally over-the-top third act are enough to deliver an experience that nobody is going to forget anytime soon. So, as a result, I recommend this film to all those who consider themselves fans of 80s and 90s horror, both studio and direct-to-video. Also, for anyone who thinks that they have seen everything there is to see in cinema, because Brian Usna has said, I will see that and I will raise you a shunting.
Yep.
So, Ryan, let's go ahead and formalize this and do a little send-off here with our film rating. What do you have, a good sir? A
lot of butt stuff in this movie. So we got like the dad with the butt head. We got the sister twisted around in the shower. And we got Clarissa.
Twisted
in bed.
Sister, you say?
Yeah, twisted sister. And we're not going to take it. So and Clarissa post-coitus in bed, twisted around. I call those good case of the front butts. So I'm giving this one 4 out of 5 front butts.
Nice. Awesome. Love that. Yeah.
Awesome. Did you say awesome?
Oh, man. So for me, I am going to go ahead and give this film 4 out of 5 twisted torsos, 3 out of 5 naked sisters, and 5 out of 5 undulating horrors from beyond. And that is all going to amount to 4.5 out of 5 stars for your boy, Jason, for
Hell yeah,
Society.
Buddy. Hell yeah.
So love this film. Would watch it again in a heartbeat right now. And it's a film that is probably going to be one of those that I drop in every 2 to 3 years just to have a wonderful time and be like, oh yeah, I forgot how absolutely insane this film is.
I'm buying this. I'm buying that Arrow DVD that you have. Absolutely.
Absolutely should. Yeah. 100%. So do want to remind you all, if you enjoyed what we're doing here, please like, subscribe, follow, rate. You know, for everybody watching on YouTube, we appreciate. For everybody listening on the podcast, we appreciate you as well. For myself, Jason Peters, and my boy Ryan Siebold, this has been Esoterica Cinema. Enjoy the movies.